Hi, you are listening to a free Majority Report. If you would like to become a member, please go to majority.fm.
Yes, Amy.
Oh, my name's Janine Garofalo. How are you?
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar, where every day's casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday. Tuesday, casual Tuesday. Wednesday, casual hump day. Thursday, casual Thurs. That's what we call it. And Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Friday, December 6, 2013. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. It's Casual Friday, ladies and gentlemen. Joining us today, Cliff Schechter. And then later, to suggest to me a movie to watch, streaming movie over the weekend, perhaps, or maybe months from now, the host of the soon, sadly, to end best show on FMU, Tom Sharpling, will be with us. Also on the program today, Nelson Mandela, dead at the age of 95. The right wing is, I mean, to be fair, they're still, if you go to the comments threads, calling him a terrorist. The world mourns and remembers perhaps one of the greatest living, fighters for justice. I mean, I think that's the best way to put it. Who is, of course, now gone. Also on the program, we will talk about President Obama's inequality speech the other day. The TPP looks to be close to getting fast-tracked, or at least the administration to getting fast-tracked authority. We will talk more about that. And Representative Sensenbrenner, the man who authored the Patriot Act, has called for Director of National Intelligence James Clapper to be prosecuted for lying to Congress. All that and more on today's program, folks. Cliff and I will talk about Nelson Mandela. I mean, you know, there's a lot of great resources online and on television to recall what this man did over his life. And I think Cliff and I will probably focus more on just what people in this country did and their perspectives on apartheid. As late as 2008, Mandela was on the U.S. terrorist watch list, an oversight, according to Colin Powell. I'm not so convinced, but we will discuss that with Cliff in just a moment. I just want to remind folks, we are being sponsored by Credo Mobile for at least, well, for this month, and they've got a deal for you over the next 2 weeks, less, basically a week and a half, 25% off your monthly data fee for 2 years. You get up to a $350 credit on your Credo bill to buy out of your current contract. And the big news is they are now offering more than just Android phones. I will say no more in that regard. You need to go to credomobile.com/Sam. We have a link on the site at Majority FM to find out what I'm talking about. But check it out. This deal will not last. I can't tell you how long it will go. I think around the 15th, maybe it'll be extended. I'm not sure. check it out. You know about Credo. They're an organization. You're going to spend money on a phone bill. If this is a company that you can check out their coverage map, if you get coverage, you now because of the expansion of the phones they're offering, you now have no reason to go over there. Your phone bill will actually go towards providing resources to progressive nonprofits, Defenders of Wildlife, Planned Parenthood, also Credo Action, the political activist wing of Credo, fights for progressive change. So check it out now. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to the great Cliff Schechter. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. It is Casual Friday, folks. And you know what that means? It means Cliff Schechter. And you know what it means when we mean Cliff Schechter? It means the Cliff Schechter theme song.
Cliff Schechter, Libertas LLC. New media, public relations, and strategy. You want any of these services? You know who you gotta see. Cliff Schechter, LibertasLLC.com.
Hello, Cliff. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you doing, Sam?
I'm doing well. It is a sad day in some respects. Nelson Mandela passed away yesterday, as I'm sure everyone is aware of now. And it's been fascinating or interesting for me, I should say, in just sort of trying to explain to my daughter who this man was. And I know, you know, you and I are of similar age and much
men of a certain age, if you will.
Yeah. And much of at least my at least to the extent that I was ever politically or first politically more aware of what's going on in the world. I mean, much of that was tied into apartheid and the apartheid movements that were pretty big, at least when I was in college. I mean, divestment was a big issue on my college campus at that time.
Yeah, my junior year in high school, Noah Shachman, who is now the editor of Foreign Policy, I don't know if you've ever had him on your show before.
I don't think so.
But you may know who he was. He used to do the, Defense Tech blog, and he did the one at Wired, the Danger Room, mm-hmm. Iran blog, and now I think he's at Foreign Policy Magazine, he's an editor. He was the student body president of my high school in New York and led a walkout my junior year where we all just walked out of class, and the teachers got all pissed off and stuff because we at the schools, to let the school's board know that we were no longer going to tolerate being invested in apartheid South Africa. And that was probably one of the first political acts I think I ever participated in. That was a big moment. There's no doubt that that was a serious part of my consciousness politically, you know, in that would have been when the mid late 80s, when that occurred, you know. And And whenever you look back at these things, it's always interesting going back, because we now, if you watch today, you even have Ted Cruz saying nice things about Nelson Mandela on his Facebook page. Read the comments, though, for fun.
Yeah, well, that's the interesting thing, is that you still see that right-wing invective, not so much from the right-wing leaders, although there are some. We have a clip we'll play of Bill O'Reilly and Rick Santorum soon. But it is it's fascinating. I mean, there are two things that are going on. One is sort of an ignoring of Nelson Mandela's broader agenda for justice.
That's right.
You know, he was not merely a civil rights leader. I mean, he was someone who fought literally for economic justice. I mean, people forget that he came out
and peace.
Yes, he came out strongly against the Iraq War. And it's you can still see, you know, the writings of right wingers as late as 2003, you know, completely disregarding this man. And, you know, I was saying in the intro of the show that, you know, there's plenty of opportunities for people to hear of this guy's legacy. But I think it's important to go back and also look at, you know, where the right was on apartheid as late as the 80s.
The mid to late, when they had the Anti-Apartheid Act in 86, I forget the name of the bill, that was to strengthen sanctions and to declare that Mandela, who had already been in prison at that point, I think, for 23 years, should be released from prison. You had Ronald Reagan, of course, opposed that.
He vetoed the bill. Government. He vetoed.
He vetoed the bill. It had to be he had to be overridden, if that's a word. They had to override him. And one of the, I wouldn't quite call him a young, let's call him a middle-aged congressman from Wyoming named Dick Cheney, of course, supported Reagan on that and voted against the bill numerous occasions and called Mandela a terrorist and called the ANC a terrorist organization. And supported apartheid South Africa. So it's always good to have, and same thing with Margaret Thatcher in England. It's always good to have this history because as we've learned recently, you know, and we've learned this throughout history, but it's just been apparent recently because we just had the 50th anniversary of John F. Kennedy's assassination. We just had the 50th anniversary earlier this year. Of the Eye of a Dream speech. And what the right loves to do is, at the time anybody is standing up for radical social change and looking at the existing order and questioning it, critiquing it, they will do anything to discredit the people doing it, calling them anything from communists to traitors to, you know, whatever it might be, and also, of course, in some cases, killing them. But it's amazing how later they always claim them for their own. Now Martin Luther King would have been a Republican. John F. Kennedy was really conservative because he cut the tax rates at the time from which were 91% all the way down to 70%, not 29%, you know, in an act of Keynesianism, not supply-side economics. And they're doing this, you know, Rosa Parks ended all racism.
Right.
Because of RNC, like, you know, or there was the National Republican Senatorial Committee, one of them, you know, tweeted out. So now they love her, even though at the time, God knows what the, you know, what people on the right were saying about her at the time. And you know, this is a pattern that the right is always on the wrong side of history. Very literally, you know, you can sit there and every single time they will be on the wrong side of history. They will attack people on the right side of history, and then they'll find a way to whitewash it 20, 30, 40, 50 years later. I mean, hell, even right now, they're busy saying, a lot of them are praising Bill Clinton to attack Obama,
right,
the guy they impeached. I mean, you literally, like, it's predictable. As you know, in 10 or 20 years, they'll be saying how great Obama was to discredit President Elizabeth Warren or Sherrod Brown or whoever comes.
I'm not so convinced of that. And I think there may be a slightly different dynamic at play when it comes to Obama. But that's certainly.
I don't know. Nothing they're saying now is worse about Obama,
right,
than what they said about Kennedy or what they said about Martin Luther King or what they said about Mandela. Nothing's worse. I mean, those guys were all terrorists. Those guys were all communist dupes. You know, those guys were all were traitors to the United States, to their own country. I mean, you know, we'll see. I'm just saying, don't put it past them to do that, to look back at Obama fondly.
Just a couple of quotes that we've dug up. Back in 1985, William Buckley wrote that the release of Mandela may one day be likened to the arrival of Lenin at the Finland station in 1917. And this, of course, is where Lenin returned to Russia from exile in Switzerland ahead of the October Revolution in Russia. I mean, this is Buckley went on to say that it continued to sort of demonize Mandela. And, you know, I mean, the reality is that Mandela did start his career engaging in violence. He was, of course, part of the ANC, which engaged in violence. He was fighting back against an incredibly violent, oppressive regime.
And there were African Americans and others in the South in, you know, 1840s that engaged in violence, and there were Jews in Germany in the 19. I mean, it's always the whole thing about one man's terrorist. Isn't it? I mean, it really depends, but. Martin Luther King had his and Gandhi had their views on violence, and my view is, you know, violence should be the last resort. But there are times when violence is required, and when a group of people are systematically torturing, murdering, dehumanizing, terrorizing, imprisoning, and doing the rest of what they were doing in South Africa, that to me, fighting back against that does not make that a terrorist act. It makes it a just act that was required.
And it also, you know, I think, you know, Peter Beinart had a pretty good piece on this, too, that Mandela was seen and the ANC was seen exclusively in the prism of of the Cold War. And he made the point that, you know, there are times where I don't have the piece right in front of me, but he made the point that that there are times when. The United States has been on the right side of freedom, and in times where it's been on the wrong side of freedom, that America's agenda is not necessarily always consistent and aligned with the notion of freedom.
No, and quite frankly, for much of the 20th century, in many places, we got it wrong. You know, we got it. We involved ourselves in Central and South America in the 50s and 60s and 70s. I mean, a lot of the blowback in Iran can be traced to what we did in overthrowing their their leader in 53, 54. I mean, you know, we were doing lots of bad things in lots of places. Not to say that America hasn't done many good things too. It's to say that. You know, we were doing, you know, these types of things. And as you pointed out, particularly in the post World War II, world, it really was, it came down to, the kind of formulation that President George W. Bush would put together. You're either with us or you're against us. And so quite frankly, anybody who had the slightest sympathies towards helping their people, socializing some of the industries that have been destroyed, you know, basically raping their people financially, that was it. You know, I mean, there still are many historians that will argue that we pushed Castro into the communist embrace. Mm-hmm. Certainly he was going to be a socialist of some sort, but we pushed him into a very different place than where he was going to be because we didn't even try to reason with him or talk to him. Sound familiar with what goes on with the guys who don't want to talk to Iran today or any of these countries? We just tried to kill him. You know, I mean, and we supported Batista, who was a murderous dictator. And you can find many others like Somoza and throughout the Americas and throughout, you know, Africa and other. So, yes, Nelson Mandela got caught up in that. He actually wanted to help his people. He saw that there had been people that had been systematically injuring his people. And for that, he had to be a communist, the way Martin Luther King had to be a communist here for making a pretty similar argument.
Right. Right. And, you know, it's it really is, though. I mean, the story of his life. To have spent 27 years in prison, more than half of those in just an ungodly, brutal prison,
yep.
And to come out and have the ability to reconcile both, I mean, to basically swallow the urge for revenge and. It's just incredibly impressive. I mean,
that to me is the most amazing part of his story, why he stands out the way he does. I mean, there are a lot of amazing things about him, but to me, that is the most amazing part because he's a better person than I am. I can say very clearly because I don't think I could have done that. And I don't think a lot of people couldn't have done that. And the sad thing is what happens is you get into these cycles of violence. You know, you see what happens when, let's say, you know, the Yugoslavia, former Yugoslavia, loses its strongman, loses Tito. And then all the ancient animosities come out. I mean, people are looking back as far ago as like 700 years before to justify killing people that look different or speak differently or worship differently. And here's this guy, you know, there hadn't been hundreds of years, hadn't been decades. He literally just, you know, got out of jail and said that we need to set up a representative government and we're going to include everybody. We're going to include the people that literally were torturing me last week. That's amazing.
Yes.
I mean, to me, that is absolutely amazing. It is something that I think very few people on this earth could do.
It really genuinely was. It's been interesting. I mean, I've just been spending time thinking about that era, particularly of the late 80s and thinking back to sort of how marginalized too those who were pushing for divestiture, and who even by elements in the sort of the liberal moderate camp, I think, we should also note that. And not every situation is analogous, both in terms of the efficacy of tactics. But there was a lot of people who said at that time, and I say this with the notion that sanctions don't always work. But for the South African Afrikaner government that perceived itself as, in many ways, sort of like part of the Western world, I guess, the sanctions, even things like the boycotting and the disallowing of their sport of them to sort of engage in sports in an international way, really ultimately had a tremendous effect, I think.
I'm sorry, I lost you for a second.
I was just saying that the notion of divestiture and of boycott, where, you know, there was a lot of people, I think, at the time who were saying, you know, the watchwords were like the Sullivan principles, which were really more in many respects about constructive engagement, I think was also the way that they talked about it. And things like boycotting and banning South African sports teams from playing and engaging in international sports. These things, which were often poo-pooed by the technocratic center, really, I think, had a tremendous effect. And you know, part
that is
of that
a great point. It's a fantastic point. It's a sort of a great description of why the so-called centrist groups like Third Way don't understand what they're doing. I'm sure you've already talked about that.
Yeah, well, you know, I want to turn to that actually, but you know, in a moment. But I just, you know, there are times where sanctions really does punish the people of a country, and ultimately serves more to strum to sort of rile up domestic support for a more antagonistic perspective towards countries. And there are also times where these type of movements, even if they are not sanctioned by the government, have impact. And, you know, I think, I'm thinking
it.
In terms of like the BDS movement against Israeli products, and in terms of creating some force for change. The dynamics are very different when you're talking about a country that perceives itself as part of sort of the Western world, as part of sort of an extended Europe. And I think, you know, there's a lot to be learned there, I think, from that. But
right. Oh, and not all boycotts are, you know, and divestiture and the rest are equal. And sanctions, quite frankly, it's what you how you choose to set up sanctions, what you choose to target, you know, a lot of this is strategic, a lot of this is in who you're hurting in the process and the message you're sending forth. I mean, it's too much to go into in sort of one conversation here. But, you know, that was a case, obviously, with South Africa, where sanctions were quite necessary, and there was something that played an important role. It played an important role in bringing together, you know, much of the world to condemn what was going on there, just as Martin Luther King's domestic boycotts played an important role here. So, I mean, you have that one thing everybody has is economic buying power. You know, you get to decide where you're going to go and spend your dollars, and, you know, you have a say in where your government does, at least theoretically. And that is an important way that change can be brought about if done in the right way. Look, I'm part of groups right now that are pushing all sorts of hedge funds and others to divest from the firearms industry.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I mean, part of that is not just a question of economics, straight economics. It's also a question of shame. And,
that's exactly
you know,
right.
I want to turn a little bit, you know, I had a good conversation yesterday with Josh Orton from Progressives United, about, what's happening with this third way battle. And it sort of ties in some respects into, President Obama's inequality speech. Let's talk a little bit about the third way, because I know, for you, you're just as passionate about this as I am.
How long do you think we can go without mocking them and making fun of them in any conversation we have about them?
I think it's very, very short. I don't think we have very much distance between. But I mean, it's fascinating that this is happening at this time. I think that we're seeing this sort of what I think is a fairly effective pushback, and much of it has to do with the composition of the Senate right now. We hear President Obama come out and speak to income inequality, and I know that we had traded that piece in the Huffington Post by Lincoln Mitchell, who had written that, you know, sort of with some measure of astonishment that President Obama is now taking the time to talk about income inequality. I guess it's never too late, but in some respects, I mean,
some respects, it actually can be too late.
Yeah.
I mean, rhetorically, it's very important, because right now, this is why you see third way striking out, and you've had a couple comments made. I mean, it was fun to watch Chuck Schumer make a comment attacking people on the left on Wall Street and then go and pretty much beg for forgiveness at Daily Kos with a diary there because of all the blowback he got from that. But you can see the sort of Wall Street, you know, and the sort of a Wall Street apologists, you know, and I mean for the worst aspects of Wall Street, because Chuck Schumer tries to make a case in that piece, as do others, that not everybody on Wall Street is bad, as if that's what we're all saying, that everybody on Wall Street is bad. We're saying there's some really bad people running some of the biggest firms right now. There's some really bad regulations that have allowed banks to become too big to fail, and that pretended that the Glass-Steagall was some outdated concept, when clearly having commercial and investment banks being separate because of the risk investment banks are willing to take was a pretty sound concept that ruled us for a long time. I mean, these are the things we're saying. We're not saying, you're saying every single person who works on Wall Street is evil. No one's saying that. And so it's you know, but in any case, this was something that this would have been the perfect thing, for example, when we've had these conversations about President Obama sort of giving in on the stimulus and asking for less. Wouldn't this have been the message to have alongside that stimulus, that we needed to put people back to work, we had enormous income inequality, the banks had just blown up the economy, and that we needed to make sure that there was a stimulus big enough to help lessen income inequality, put people, I mean, it would have been this strong populist message when he had 59 senators and a House majority, and I promise you, if he had pushed this kind of thing, this kind of messaging, 2010 would never have happened, all right, and at least in the manner in which it did. But you're right. There's still, in my opinion, are things he can do now. And I'm writing a piece right now where I'm kind of outlining three of the things. But in terms of getting legislation passed, obviously there's very little he could do.
Right.
But it's really disingenuous to get up and have that speech when you're trying to get fast track authority on the transpartisan or trans whatever the hell
Trans-Pacific partnership. And
thank you. I was losing the words.
And today, Annie Lowry in the New York Times reports that the House and Senate are supposedly nearing an agreement that would provide for fast track. Now, I had read, I guess it was a couple of weeks ago, that there was 100 some odd Democrats, maybe around 130, and then maybe about another 25, 27 Republicans who had committed to fighting fast track.
Right.
But I mean, this TPP we've spoken about on this program. I'm going to try and have somebody else on again. There's only so much we know about this, but what we do know at the heart, essentially, it eliminates
multinational corporations a lot more power and literally almost the power to override sovereign nations.
No, not almost. I mean, literally the power to override or basically say, if you're going to pass labor protections, if you're going to pass environmental protections, if you're going to pass consumer protections, then you have to pay us X number of dollars based upon our profit projections. And we've seen some of that in NAFTA. We've seen instances where the Canadian government has had to pay money to U.S. corporations that anticipated making more profit there but couldn't because of some of their environmental regulations. We've seen it go the other way. We also know
we've tried this crap. You know, it's just amazing to me. We've done this for 20 years now. You know, and I invite some of these people that think this is a brilliant idea. Why don't you take a drive through Youngstown or somewhere like that? It's not to say that we wouldn't have been in certain disadvantages to countries that are willing to have slave, you know, labor essentially, or not really essentially, have that. And we would have lost some of our manufacturing base. But we've literally put it on the express train in this country through the trade deals we've passed. We've literally destroyed, we've done what Walmart's done to certain towns or many towns. And just emptied them out. And that you could stand there and make an argument about how we need to fight income inequality and then support this thing. I mean, you're either being completely disingenuous, or let's just use the word, you're lying, or they've got a really mixed up understanding of what this thing does.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of disingenuousness involved in this. Now, the one thing that I wonder, I haven't yet seen anybody write about this, but I anticipate we'll see it over the coming weeks or so. Is Jack Lew announced, I think he was at the Pew, the Pew Charitable Trust. He announced that supposedly financial regulations that emanate from this country will not be watered down as a function of this trade deal and another trade deal that we are striking. And both of these are being done and negotiated completely in secret. To the extent that we know what's in them is only because somebody has leaked certain chapters of this massive deal, or because individual members of the House have actually gotten some draft stuff from from corporate representatives who are involved. I mean, so Congress has not even seen any of this yet. And Jack Lew announced sometime this week, earlier this week, that Dodd-Frank regulations will not be watered down as a function of this. And what that tells us is that, assuming that he's telling us the truth, but nevertheless, that were those financial regulations included in this, and I'm not convinced they won't be, frankly, but that this is a dynamic that's going to take place in other areas in terms of so-called intellectual property, in terms of environmental regulations, in terms of consumer protections. So we're going to see the lowest common denominator, the weakest of these laws.
Price gouging on medicine. And I mean, it's sickening what could end up happening under this.
Yes, these weakest of these laws, wherever they are around the globe, or at least amongst the partners that have signed on to this, the weakest one is then going to become not just the baseline, but it's going to become the ceiling. And whether or not an individual country has violated and sort of attempted through their democratic process to supersede these standards, a corporate board, a board made up literally of corporate lawyers who were rotated
kind of like third ways board.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Let's talk about this, because this is a part and parcel of the same thing. The third way is very supportive of the TPP. These are the people who are out there, lobbying for fast track. The reason why they want fast track ostensibly is to give the president authority to pass this trade deal. There's another way to do that. That is have Congress know what's in this deal. and take a whip count.
But they
don't want any real debate on this. They don't want the ability for a filibuster. They don't want the ability for amendments to fix certain parts of this. So we've got this just, part of this corporate establishment of which Third Way is not simply a part of, but is completely indicative of.
Well, they on the Democratic side of the aisle, they're at the epicenter of it. And they, they're the ones pushing for cutting, basically privatizing part of Social Security. They're pushing for cuts to Medicare, and they're pushing for trade deals like this. They're sort of the remnants of the old DLC that's been completely eliminated. Most of these terrible Congress members, a lot of them who were the worst on some of these issues were kicked out in 2010. Shockingly, people on the progressive side weren't that motivated to come out and vote for their own congressmen. And, but these guys literally have no constituency but a bunch of billionaires and a bunch of people, on Morning Joe and sitting around in Washington, D.C., together, and a bunch of investment bankers, some of whom have already paid huge corporate fines, and the rest, the whole board's made up of investment bankers. And again, this is not, I'm not saying all investment bankers are evil, to say, but these guys have certain interests, right? And they're Third Way, basically trying to pretend that the Democratic Party, that populism is crazy. Oh my God, it's just Elizabeth Warren and Bill de Blasio, these two morons wrote in their Wall Street Journal op-ed. As if nothing, those are the only two populist wins, right? It wasn't, for example, it wasn't Newt Gingrich who got that as much traction as he did by going populist himself and going after Mitt Romney for coming into towns and places and destroying them by firing people. You didn't have people like Sherrod Brown in Ohio winning and Tom Harkin and Tammy Baldwin. I don't remember Wisconsin or Ohio or Iowa being considered deep blue states. Not to mention you've got Mark Begich signing up for increasing Social Security right now and plenty of others. So in the end, they're giving a completely inaccurate picture of where they see the writing on the wall. The vast majority of the Democratic Party is against this trade deal, believes we should add to Social Security, as Elizabeth Warren and Sherrod Brown and Tom Harkin and the rest have said. Believe that we should be there are plenty of ways, right? Medicare is spending way too much money. And why is it spending that? Is it the care that it's giving to people, or are we overpaying providers? Or are we refusing to have bulk negotiate for prescription drugs to bring down the cost? Are we refusing to reimport drugs to bring down the cost? And there's plenty of ways the cost can be brought down for these programs without hurting people. But that's not what these guys want, because Big Pharma's on their board.
Right.
They don't want to cut away any of their profits. The Medicare cuts they're talking about come from you and me.
We should make it clear that the notion that this is not about them saying that in some way populism is not going to be helpful from a political standpoint for Democrats. I've told this story, I think, many times on this program, but it bears repeating that someone who is a very big supporter of the program and been very supportive of this program over the years, she had written me years ago in 2008 about an exchange she had with Bob Rubin at a fundraiser for, I think it was for a theater. Aside from telling the story of how Bob Rubin...
Or as Bob Rubin calls it, a theater.
Right. Well, there's two aspects of this. So one part is just sort of an interesting story that I think is really indicative of who people like Bob Rubin are. Apparently, he was really pissed when he got to the fundraiser because he had been stuck in traffic in Manhattan in the town car that he was being driven in. And
he wasn't on the bus?
He had called the mayor's office to complain about the traffic and had spoken to the assistant mayor to complain about the traffic. And when she asked him, where were you when you were stuck in traffic? And he said, I had no idea. I mean, the guy travels these streets without any concept of where he is, but picks up the phone to call the mayor's office to complain about the traffic. Just this sort of notion that he's living in his own private Idaho, except for Idaho for him is really just sort of more like his own private
Davos.
Well, it's
a car and driver in like interchangeable cities of the world.
Indeed.
He could have been in Hong Kong or London or, I'm surprised he didn't call the mayor of Shanghai by mistake.
Right, exactly. And so she was talking to him about who she supported, and at that time it was John Edwards, And the guy said, Bob Rubin said, you know, that can't happen. I mean, he's a populist. And, you know, put aside whether or not John Edwards was sincere in that regard, there is a tremendous fear. I mean, make no doubt about it. This is about them fearing a populist resurrection in the Democratic Party are consciously trying to subjugate, because that is not where their interests lie. And for them...
No, it's indirect. I mean, when you get to the point where you don't know where you are in traffic and you don't exactly know where your car and driver has taken you, but you know it's all cool, you've really gotten to that point where it's in direct contravention to your interests, because
absolutely,
all your interests are amassing more wealth and power for yourself. It's not really about paying the bills anymore, is it?
Absolutely. And the reality is that for the Democratic Party, for the Democratic establishment, unlike the Republican establishment, the left brand of populism is a far greater threat to the Democratic establishment. And to the center, so-called center left of the Democratic Party, than right wing populism is, because right wing populism really rarely runs at odds with the right wing agenda. Maybe you see it on immigration on some level, because it takes the form of nativism and xenophobia. But beyond that, it is rare that there's a conflict there. It is at the heart of the conflict in the Democratic Party. And that's why these guys are out there.
I would say it's basically, to me right now, it's a fight between those who believe. I mean, it really breaks down very clearly on clear sort of lines. So those who believe that since the time of FDR, government's not an outdated concept. It is the best thing out there, the federal government, to protect people economically, to make sure that, you know, rapacious industries aren't destroying the environment, aren't hurting people. And those who believe in sort of these neoliberal fantasies, to use their language, that you can, you know, pretty just, you don't need to regulate, you just provide little incentives, and businesses then will do the right thing. And these guys have led this mass effort, and I think this is where a lot of this war is being fought. Certainly Social Security is part of it, which is it's a war on whether we're going to, you know, have faith in the government, and the government is going to be what we believe is an instrument of equality, or we're going to privatize everything, right, and throw everything into the free market, because the free market is king. And I think that's it. These guys are the ones who are trying to privatize our schools.
Right.
You know, so that they can profit from it. You know, I came across something I wanted to say before you kicked me off the show, because I know time is drawing to an end here. But a group that I've become a fan of, which is called In the Public Interest, which has these reports they put out pointing out, like, you know, these privatization nightmares, you know, and they just released a report, and Gawker had an article up that was really interesting, you know, and they just sort of bullet pointed these things. You know, I mean, Chicago, Cincinnati, thankfully, was going to do this, and it got voted down this past election. But Chicago under Rahm Emanuel privatizing their parking meters, which has been a disaster. The price goes up for people. Accountability and any transparency disappear. You know, they just tell you, we don't need to show you our what we're doing. We don't need to tell you stuff. People's wages get lowered. You know, I mean, they've got this bullet. I'll just read the top of this bullet point list here. Los Angeles County continually renewed its $3 million contract with a firm called Wings of Refuge to place foster children, despite numerous reports of kids going to abusive homes where they were beaten and locked away for days on end. And they kept doing it. And you go through this list at Gawker, you'll find numerous things of this, and they'll remind you of everything that you know about in the news. They'll also remind you of when you privatize things, like, let's say, setting up a government wealth website for healthcare,
right,
you know, instead of doing it in-house. They screw that up, too. It's this whole myth, and I guess I'll just end by saying this, that this, to me, is what I'm waiting for from Obama, besides opposing, and I may just be waiting forever, of course,
right,
besides opposing this trade deal, and besides saying Elizabeth Warren and her and Sherrod Brown and these guys are right, we need to be adding to Social Security, because this is one of the few things that protects people, as guaranteed pensions have disappeared, you know, who you know, talking about the income inequality we have out there right now, that we need to stop this fantasy that privatizing things works, and that the private sector, as we've been told for 30 years now, is more efficient than government. No, Medicare is a hell of a lot more efficient than private insurance, because they don't pay bloated salaries to executives who don't do anything, and they don't have overhead up the wazoo because they don't care, and they don't spend all their money on marketing. And what, I mean, you know, this is what we're going, and this is a battle taking place. You know, you can make a difference, whoever's listening here, because this isn't just federal. This is going on in cities and towns and states near you, where this war by these guys, mostly guys on Wall Street, that just wish to make more money by privatizing everything. That's the side that Third Way is on.
Right.
You know, and that's the side their board members are on. They want to privatize everything from your Medicare becoming vouchers to your Social Security being put in the stock market to your local benches, parking meters, parks, and anything else that you use on a daily basis, transportation and the rest. Does the government do it better, or do they do it better? And the fact is that Reagan had it wrong. It's the government that does it better, and you could see that if you look at that and get past the myth again and again and again about how inefficient, corrupt, and the rest of big business is. We've had plenty of examples in the last decade or so, from Enron to AIG, haven't we? So, okay,
exactly.
I'm done with my rant. So I want to see Obama. That's, to me, is the third plank that we need to see from Obama, is to stop speaking like a conservative and talking about, you know, business does a better job here. They do not.
And you know, frankly, you know, at this point, talk is cheap. I mean, literally, it is cheap for him. There is no cost for President Obama to speak with some measure of populism. The reality is that we've got to see it play out when it comes to things like the budget. We've got to see it come out in issues like appointments, now that he has a clear path to nominees and particularly judges. And we have to see it in things like, the TPP. I mean, this is a really big deal that I don't think that I think has really been under covered. And to a certain extent, it's because there's simply no information about it. But what we know is enough, I think, to alarm people. And I would argue, you know, that frankly, it's and maybe I'm deluding myself, but also see some of it. I mean, to the extent if there is any sincerity on behalf of the libertarians who don't want to see corporate giveaways, to the Tea Partiers who are afraid of a one-world government, I mean, the TPP should be their biggest nightmare. And I'm not going to hold my breath, but it is this is something that we should be seeing just a lot more. You know, this is one of those few areas where I feel like a transpartisan coalition is called for, because I think it could be effective.
Yeah.
But we've got to watch this fast track. It's just absolutely crucial. But Cliff, we're out of time. As always, a pleasure.
It's a pleasure. I feel a little sad because I don't feel like we spent quite enough time mocking Third Way.
I know, but I did.
Maybe we can
fair,
make that like a weekly feature. Can we do that?
I think they're going to probably lay low for a little bit. Although Josh Horton had a great, he had a great theory that this was also a function of them basically needing fundraising. That this is a sign of their weakness, because why else would you come out with such a stupidly timed attack on a on someone who is ascendant in the Democratic Party? But hope springs eternal in that regard. Cliff Schechter, thanks so much for joining us.
All right, thanks for having me on, buddy.
All right, folks, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Tom Sharpling, whose best show on FMU not only has been a staple of WFMU, which is a community radio station in New Jersey, and via the internet now, is just wildly popular around not just the country. It was also the genesis of the Majority Report. And I will explain when Tom Sharpling comes on to the program. We'll be right back after this. I turn my camera on. I call Ladies and gentlemen, it is now my great pleasure and honor to welcome to the program, I believe this is at least the second time on this program, the host, the creator of not just I was going to get to that in a second, specifically the best show on WFMU, aptly named. Because it's, you know, at least arguably the best show on WFMU. Tom Sharpling.
Yeah. Hey.
Hey.
How are you?
Good. Now
Did I undercut your intro there?
No, not at all. You have been in radio for at least several months longer than me, and so I defer to your expertise.
Well, no, you are truly the master of this form, and. You grow, watching me become the student, has been I was eye opening. But it's that kind of thing where when Sonny Rollins heard John Coltrane play, he went through his saxophone off the bridge.
There you go, there you go. And now, Michael just called you sensei, and in some ways, yes, you are the sensei. I know that we talked about this last time you were on, but it bears repeating, particularly in light of the fact that you are winding the show down. I want to talk about that, but you launched the Majority Report back in February of 2003.
Yes.
Well, expand.
A young Sam Cedar, newly politicized, newly. Hey, you, at that point, you had heard all about this George W. Bush character, and
yes.
You were mad.
I was mad.
You were mad. Ashcroft.
The PNAC, the Project for a New American Century. Now, let me ask you this. So Sharpling invites me to take over 2 hours of your show at that time, you'd been doing it for like 2 or 3 years at least at that point, right?
Yes, yeah, 3 years in at that point.
And so John Benjamin and I went out to New Jersey. Benjamin did the intro live.
The intro.
And yeah.
It's the Majority Report.
Exactly. And I had Janine Garofalo as a guest. I got some guy from Fox and Friends on the weekends. you remember that?
Yeah, yeah. Yes, I do. Like some guy who was just completely, he had no idea what was going on.
No.
And you were so ramped up. You're at 10.
Yes.
And this guy's like, wait, what am I on? Like a college radio station? And this guy is now... he's playing Gotcha with me now, and I'm on trial apparently. Like, what is this thing that I've never heard of? And now this guy's trying to end my career.
Yes, it was. I guess in retrospect, I mean, I didn't perceive it that way at the time, but I totally sandbagged him. To the point where he's like, he said, I don't really know that much about international affairs. We were like 2 months out, month out from literally bombing the hell out of Iraq. And, this guy was like, I don't know much about international affairs. And I made him justify Bill O'Reilly. I made him justify Sean Hannity. It was probably rude of me, at the time, but it was
exciting. It was very exciting. And I think you had also bought like a miniature vodka bottle, like an airport plain bottle, a bottle, so you could kind of.
I was nervous.
It was either you were nervous, but you were, you knew you wanted to do that kind of thing, and you were serious about it. So it was like, yeah, I have this thing. Why not share this thing that I've got in terms? If this, because also people might not realize in 2003 technology, it might as well have been 1975.
Yeah,
because you couldn't just go mount your own thing just because you wanted to. It still wasn't there yet. We're a couple of years away from that flexibility that people have now, where they, if they want to say something, they can create their own podcast and get it out there. You did not have that at your disposal.
And there was literally nowhere in any media. I mean, I guess, you know, you would see some in some print media. And certainly this was starting to happen with sort of like what, you know, with nascent blogs at the time. But there was no mass media at all that was providing any measure of dissent. I mean, that's what was really stunning. You go back and look at, like, you know, it was like Jerry Nachman on MSNBC at the time. They were Fox Light. Maybe not even light is the right word. There was nothing. I mean, Donahue was, had been canceled at that point, because he was, you know, speaking out against the war. There was no liberal talk radio in any, significant way. I mean, occasionally you'd hear a local show here or there, but there was nothing.
And it was the easiest thing for people to shout down. Just anybody. All you had to do, people had their choice of trump cards that could shut anybody who was dissenting down. It's shocking now when you see how it is now. Could you imagine what Twitter would have been like then?
Right.
Twitter in 2002, 2003.
Or YouTube.
Like, do you think YouTube would it have accelerated the possibility of dissent being an option?
I can't help but think it would. I mean, maybe Twitter would just be overrun with people who, like, if you dared to say, hey, maybe we shouldn't do this because there's weapons inspectors on the ground, you'd just be hammered relentlessly. It would be like, you know, just like a 24/7 Twitchy or whatever that is, that Michelle Malkin's got going.
Yeah, it would. Maybe they would even. Who knows? Maybe they would even be suspending accounts and stuff under the guise of people. Who knows? Sounds like a science fiction movie.
Now, the other thing that, you know, it occurs to me in terms of what you've done for my career or absence of said career is not only did you launch the Majority Report at that time.
Yeah.
But I don't know if you remember this, but and I don't think at the time I was fully conscious of this. I mean, back in the early days, I was one of those people who would call in and do some comedy bits with you occasionally.
Yes.
And on Tuesday, November, whatever it was, the year 2000, of the election, I called into your program at about 9 p.m., I think it was, because that's when it started. I think it was right at the beginning. And I called in as Al Lieberman, Joe Lieberman's wayward son, who was complaining that who was a tennis pro in West Palm Beach. This is before any of the West Palm Beach stuff had come out that night. It was a character I was doing. You let me call in on the show and complain about how my dad wouldn't let me campaign for him in West Palm Beach. Little did we know at that time that the election would center around West Palm Beach at that time. But I went on to make a movie that turned out to be a complete, really disaster, because I was encouraged by your allowing me to come on a legitimate media outlet and do that character. So thank you.
Sure. Well, you're welcome. You realize, though, that talking doesn't cost anything.
Right.
Right. When you do a character and you're just saying it versus when you decide to go film that character and all of the things that brings about. I do remember one time I was financing a video shoot for Midnight Pajama Jam. And
tell people what Midnight Pajama Jam was, though. This is Benjamin.
It was a show that John Benjamin and John Blazer did, where it started off as a kids show, and halfway through the first one, they started cursing, and it suddenly became not a kids show necessarily. And so they were like, "Let's do a DVD of this." Like, yeah, let's do that. And then we filmed it, and I remember putting up like $1,000 and then not knowing I'd never get it back. But you said to me that night, you're like, "Welcome to the club. Good to see someone else. Good to see someone else losing some money for once."
I could tell you that I lost.
I've never forgotten that, the idea that I was in the club, and it felt kind of good in a way. It's like, hey, I'm in the club.
I cannot.
The money losing club.
I can't even begin to tell you. I do not. I can't. I mean, I spent exponentially more than $1,000 on the on both A Bad Situationist and Who's the Caboose. I feel like I earned it back with Who's the Caboose, if not directly from the movie, but from sort of like, you know, what it did for my career. But A Bad Situationist was just a bad situation that at that time I was still sort of reeling from, because it was so much money that I had spent on that.
Do you have a number? Is there a number? There a number you can throw out, or is that private business?
Well, I mean, look, I had done the pilot for According to Jim. And, you know, I don't know if people have a sense of just how much money was involved, particularly at that time, although I imagine the dollar figures are similar today, how much money you could make on a pilot, even if you were like the third character. But I had basically taken all that money and more and put it into A Bad Situationist. And we're talking close to six figures. So, I mean, and I'm not, and that's before you get to the decimal point, I should make clear. I mean, that was just what I did. I was following at that time sort of Cassavetes model. I was following
Coppola.
Well, no, not like Coppola, because Coppola had other people pay for his things.
He went broke plenty of times.
Yeah, I guess he sunk his money in afterward. I was following like a Cassavetes model. I would do, you know, sort of more commercial projects and then finance my less commercial projects. But it was, you know, I've got some DVDs sitting around. If you want one, let me know.
Wait, you still have some?
Oh God, yeah. I'm thinking of making furniture out of them. I got so many.
What if you made one of those things, you know, when you could do, they do like those portraits, and then you look and they're all like little pictures of things, and it's like, what if you actually made one of those out of all of the DVDs you have?
Do you have
that and Who's the Caboose?
Do you have a 10-story building where you can authorize me to use the side of it to make it?
What if you did it? And then you just attribute it to Banksy, that Banksy did this, and then you sell it for $15 million.
I would need
all the money.
I would need a very big, like one of those cherry pickers, because I would need a big space to use all the DVDs I got for that. So, all right. So now let's get to the heart of the matter here. What are you doing?
Well, I've done the show for 13 years, and it's kind of just at a point where it's on a non-commercial station, and it's just that thing. It takes so much. The show takes more and more time. It's pretty much a full-time job.
Yep.
When it's all said and done, and I can't, it's something I do on a radio station that's free, and I don't have the, for me to do the show the way I need to do it, I can't do it for free anymore. Like, it's just like, I just can't, either the show's going to suffer and I can spend less time on it and then do it that way, but I wouldn't want to do that show. And the other option is to, I have to stop doing it.
Yeah.
Because I can't.
Well, you got to figure out a way of getting paid for that show, because it's a great show. And I know how much work you have to put into that thing on a weekly basis. And I also understand the sort of like the how relentless it is when you want each one to be good. I mean, that's the thing that I think, yeah. You know, that people don't understand. And particularly if, you know, you're doing it for 13 years for free. This is something that you are heavily emotionally invested in. And the idea of going out there and doing a show that you haven't been able to spend as much time as you know needs to be spent on the show to do to attempt to do what you want to do is just gut wrenching.
Yes, it's really, I could have made this decision 2 years ago, but I just like doing the show so much and it's so satisfying to do. That I kept doing it in spite of a very harsh reality that was always staring me back in the face.
Well,
so
I hope that you are trying to figure out, and you know, we do live in an age now where, you know, so much of your audience, I mean, people, you know, you've got two more shows left, right?
Two more episodes. Yeah.
And
then I'm kind of going to take a little bit of a breather and then figure out, I just need to figure out what's what. If I go get a job, then that's what I'm going to focus on. If I'm working on a show or something, then that's going to be my focus for 2014. There's no reason for me to stop talking into microphones, and because I like doing it and people like when I do it. And the outpouring has been just insane from people just saying how much the show has meant to them and still means to them. And it's like that there's something reinvigorating about that I was not even necessarily counting on. It's not false modesty. It's just like, I really am taken aback by how many people are bummed that the show is ending. So it's just kind of knowing that people are there. That's another thing. And I am ready to entertain all options and see what's what. But one option might be that I don't do it anymore. One option might be doing it on my own. Who knows? I truly don't have an answer right now. But I just need to end the show that I've done for 13 years, like fair and square. And I want that to be... I want to do that right, and that's what we've been trying to do. So,
let me give you the best piece of advice that I can give you. Having gone from, you know, in many respects,
make a movie out of it.
Yes. No. Buy as many DVDs as you possibly.
Okay.
Here, no. Honestly, here's my one piece of advice to you, because you know I went through a similar thing at one point over the course of Air America. I was going to. Launch essentially this podcast, but because of things that happened internally at Air America, it didn't happen. And I ended up doing that show with, what's his face?
Mark Maron.
And, yeah. And I took, basically 6 to 8 months to a year off. Following the demise of Air America, which was problematic. But the one thing that allowed me to launch this show, and you know, and we're still not where we want to be, even 3 years in, frankly, but you know, we're doing this 5 days a week. But the one thing that allowed me to do that was I had email addresses of people who wanted to know about the show. And that happened because on multiple occasions, Air America, internally, there were threats to fire me. There was bad blood. And I told people I started to build an email list. And you got two shows. Do it. I don't know if you already have one, but go out, get a Constant Contact or one of these email lists and put a sign up on your website and get everybody to sign up, because you're going to want to be able to do this as quickly as possible. And you don't want people to have to find out that you're doing it again, because I still meet people literally.
You seem convinced that I'm coming back.
Well, I'm convinced that you're not going to be able to stay away. I mean, it's possible. Look, you know, people don't know this about you, but you were the head writer of Monk for many years. And
yeah.
You're a great writer. In fact, I just gave Judah Benjamin a 2-year subscription to Slam magazine.
Mm-hmm. Which I wrote for.
Basketball fan. I know how much, you know, you love doing it, and I know how much it gets into your blood, and it's hard not to. And so I'm telling you, collect some email addresses.
All right.
Do it. You got two more nights.
I'll collect some email addresses.
You got to do it.
You're talking about, I'm at 82,000 on Twitter, too, bro.
Yeah. Twitter's not as effective. Wait, you're 82,000 on Twitter? Are you verified?
I think it's a check.
You know.
Yeah. You kidding?
How the F did you get verified?
You.
Unbelievable.
Because I'm the real deal. That's how. You want me to get you verified? I'll get you verified in a week. You tell me. You just say, Tom, get me. Can you please get me verified? I'll get you verified.
I don't know. I have I have some issues with the verification thing. I find it a little bit obnoxious. But
then just know this. As soon as you say that sentence to me, 1 week later, you'll have a blue check next to your name.
All right. Well, I'm going to keep that in my back pocket and see if I can't leverage that.
Until then, you're going to have parody accounts, Sam Cedar, where it's like a Q instead of an E, and it tricks people into thinking it's you, and then you do it. That you're prey to all that stuff.
Well, maybe I'll make a bet with somebody that I'll get verified. I mean, I got to figure out a way of leveraging this. But all right. Well, now, Tom, let's get to the to the heart of the matter. As you know, and I haven't seen you socially in years, and that's
in years.
And that's because basically I don't go out anymore. I don't know if you go out.
I don't either.
Oh, all right. Well, so it's a function of both of us being shut-ins in some manner. I can't go out because I was just at the brink of being able to go out and then accidentally had another kid. Well, not accidentally, but you know how that goes. Absent-mindedly had another child.
Okay.
And so now I am... I'm not free to go out. I actually had a fluke last night, and we had a babysitter because I thought I was going to do, you know, a hit on MSNBC, and I didn't. And then I didn't know what to do with myself. I walked around the city for like 4 hours, just beleaguered.
Okay.
But so when I want to see a movie, I have to watch it on Apple TV or Roku or through some other mechanisms, which, you know, you can now get thrown in jail, I think, if you mention on radio. But what movie should I watch?
Well, I would say you should watch. Have you seen the Salinger documentary yet?
No.
It's kind of boring.
Oh. All right. Sold.
It's about half of it's good, because it's also just talking about a guy writing books and not talking to anybody, so there's only so long you can talk about that and show the same four pictures of him that they have. But it's interesting to hear people talk about his World War II experiences, which were a lot more intense than I thought they were.
Huh.
So
was this done by like a former girlfriend or something? Or no?
He was in love with the young woman who went on to marry Charlie Chaplin. When he went and he found out, he got a Dear John letter, not a Dear John letter. He found out from reading the gossip rags over in Europe. that his girlfriend was now married to Charlie Chaplin.
Ooh, well, that doesn't sound like they were that close at the time. I mean, you want to go out and get a drink tonight? I can't. I got some other engagement. And then you find out, like, literally, it was another engagement.
Yes. I say Salinger. Watch that.
Yeah. All right. I mean, sort of boring. That's probably one of the weakest sort of recommendations you could give a movie. But I guess it's better than totally boring.
It's like eating vegetables.
All right.
You'll be happy you saw it, but you didn't love it necessarily.
All right.
Look, I wouldn't kill myself to see this thing. So let's try it. I say try it on Versailles and see what you think.
All right, fair enough. Tom Sharpling saying, what's it called, Salinger or just?
Salinger.
All right. It's not totally boring, is what Tom Sharpling says.
Not totally.
Not totally boring. Somewhat boring, but not totally. All right. Done. Well, I'm going to be tuning in Tuesday night, 9 p.m. Eastern time. So many people tune in, I imagine, through the website. I mean, of course, regionally here, but now, you know, you can actually stream this thing. And that, you know, in many respects, I think sort of like made your show explode in many respects. And so, you know, I hope you know that there's technology that allows you to do that afterwards. And I'm sure, you know, we'll hear from you again in January. But
look, all I'll say, I don't know what I'm going to do, but I'm not dead. I'm not retired. I'll do something.
There you go,
something.
Folks. Tom Sharpling will do something. On that note, yes, the start of every great empire.
Thanks.
All right. Thank you, Tom. Thanks for coming on.
No, that was a lot of fun. You're always the best.
Oh.
My hero.
Sweet. You are you're mine as well. All right, Tom, let's try eventually to go out and, you know, maybe, I don't know, grab a coffee, get a drink.
Let's figure it out. I will.
All right. See you in 5 years.
I love it.
See you in 5 years.
Thanks, buddy.
Bye-bye.
All right.
All right, folks. Well, we might as well just keep going. Another Freebie Friday. Can you believe we did this?
It's getting to be every Friday now, I think.
I know. You know, one thing that I got to warn people that we're contemplating here is shutting down Fridays and giving it only to members.
Completely. Completely shutting down Fridays. Just to
make
it clear. The whole Friday show would be a members only. It wouldn't be two halves.
I'm getting a lot of pressure to do this.
From the upper...
from the brass. The executive committee and the board of directors and the development committee.
Mr. Soros.
The committee to get Michael to speak directly into his microphone.
My mic was not up.
Yeah, okay,
no,
just,
it was. It
point
was.
It towards your mouth.
What? Your mic was up.
How many emails do we have to get? Michael can't even work the stand. That's the problem.
How's this?
Much
That's
better.
Good. That's much better.
Great. All right, I forgot what I was going to say, but I guess.
Mr. Soros, you said.
Yeah.
I said Mr. Soros, Nikki.
Mr. Soros.
I'm getting it from all
probably
sides.
Probably the super at your building.
Yes. Everybody. Adolfo downstairs.
Adolfo downstairs is brilliant. Adolfo is the guy.
With internet marketing, you mean?
Yeah, he's a brilliant in internet marketing, absolutely.
What were you going to say? What do you mean he's brilliant? What does that mean?
No, it's just every morning I come in, he has something very smart and astute to say about politics.
Really?
Yeah.
Maybe we should have like a
he
segment
was talking,
where he comes
he,
upstairs
he was telling
and
me
a...
about his thoughts on Mandela this morning. Oh. And they were like incredibly well put.
What did he say?
Well, he said he was most impressed by his capacity for forgiveness, which is actually what you guys were saying. And I think what's cool about it, though, is that it was like, yes, he had this tremendous capacity to forgive, but there was also there was strategy behind it. You know, he was also this really brilliant political tactician.
He said, according to his biographer, that that nonviolence for him was not a principle. It was a tactic.
Well, and he actually never, as a point of principle, would not renounce violence in order to get released from prison. Even as he had kind of recognized that the ANC, because frankly, just violence didn't do much for the ANC.
Right.
The other things they did were much more effective. But on principle, he would not renounce that arm of the ANC in order to get released from prison.
Yes.
So there was this steeliness to it, you know, like in his one of his debates with de Klerk for president, he hit de Klerk really, really hard. And then after it was over and the cameras could still see, he went and shook his hand and said, you know, I hope you'll help me work on all of this. And I think, you know, he obviously compassion, forgiveness and everything and reconciliation. But he was shrewd.
Yep.
And he didn't let, you know, people get away with things either.
Yeah, really an amazing man in many respects. All right, let's. Well, I guess we're gonna just stick with this. The number 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920.
We should definitely make sure we get to this Bill O'Reilly and Rick Santorum sound.
Oh yeah, all right, let's play this now. I mean, this is stunning. I mean, Bill O'Reilly. This is we're watching the right now dealing with Mandela's legacy. It is amazing how these guys trip all over themselves to seem even-handed and fair and still either say something astonishingly stupid or astonishingly mendacious. And fortunately for you, we have both in one clip. Here is Bill O'Reilly bringing the mendacity and Rick Santorum bringing the stupidity. Here it is.
Let me give you an example. Ideology has to really leave the building next year and in 2016, or you're going to have President Hillary Clinton. Nelson Mandela just died. I don't know whether you're aware, but 95 years old.
Yeah.
Nelson Mandela, I spent some time in South Africa. He was a communist, this man.
Yeah.
He was a communist, all right? But he was a great man. What he did for his people was stunning.
Pause it. Now, I don't want to... I'm sure Bill O'Reilly has spent some time in South Africa, at maybe even at a nice resort. Apparently there, they didn't have any books or newspapers or internet where he could look up and realize that Nelson Mandela was not only not a communist... early on in his career, he was quite adamant about keeping the communists out of any coalition, as well as Indians in his struggle. But even when he was the head of the ANC, he was not a communist, but continue.
Sacrifices that he made. He could have repudiated and got out of that prison. He wouldn't do it. He was a great man, but he was a communist. So, but I would never attack Nelson Mandela. I mean, I told Bishop Tutu I disagree with you and with Mr. Mandela because Tutu's that way as well, but I respect you. So why can't you guys in the Republican Party bring that to the fore?
Well, Nelson Pause. Mandela...
Now, I'm not clear what that to the fore is, but I think what Bill O'Reilly is saying, I'm trying to reposition myself based upon the memo we got to make it sound like we're not an apparatus of the Republican Party. So what do you say? I'll let you have the last word, Rick Santorum.
Up against a great injustice and was willing to pay a huge price for that, and that's the reason he's mourned today because of that struggle that he performed. But you're right. I mean, what he was advocating for was not necessarily the right answer, but he was fighting against some great injustice. And I would make the argument that, you know, we have a great injustice going on right now in this country with an ever increasing size of government that is taking over and controlling people's lives, and Obamacare is front and center in that. And
there you have it, folks. Obamacare is like apartheid. Obamacare is like the repression. Literal repression of the majority of Americans. Americans under Obamacare, a vast majority of them, can't eat in the same restaurants, must live in slums, can't have access to the natural resources of their country, cannot have an equal vote, cannot have... I mean, that's what Obamacare is. For Rick Santorum, because he's so, so stupid. Yeah, you want to do Mandela?
It was like in Santorum's mind, Mandela comes out and he's like, of all of the injustices in the world that could remind me of the struggle against apartheid, the delivery of health care through a private market mechanism, none could face the same level of injustice and tyranny that Americans face by having an inconvenient website. So that they are covered in a catastrophic situation. You should fight this.
Now, I want to know, when's Rick Santorum going to go into prison for 27 years to fight this? Unbelievable.
The names Santorum, Gingrich, and other heroes of the struggle... against the slightly expanded Medicaid. You will go down in history along with Otto Vertombo, Walter Sisulu, and other great comrades who have fought an evil injustice.
Oh.
How demented are these people?
So
it's
demented.
It's so much better if they could just say Mandela was a communist. Screw him.
Oh.
I mean, my God.
Right. You can see Santorum walking off the set and going to his aide or whatever it is, going, I should have just said, you know, the guy was a communist. I blew that one.
Should have just stuck with Marxist Rick.
When Bill O'Reilly was leading me right there. Why did I?
I don't know why I did that. I really screwed that one up. Let's
check out Christmas Candle.
Can you get me on Pat, get me on.
They are trying to rob the children of a happy Christmas. The only thing you can do is buy gold at this point.
Can you get me on PTN? Can you get me on one of those shows? I'll talk about abortion again or something like that. I don't.
There's conservative Mandela. They want to take his legacy. There you go. Buy gold.
Oh, God. Unbelievable. Should we do a random rush? Oh, I think it's too late.
Really?
Let's try it. All right, folks. Let's see if he's on.
Well, I mean, just like they do with...
Okay. All right, folks, it's that time again for Random Rush. You know what that means. I listen to Random Rush to Rush Limbaugh for 60 seconds. I respond in 90. It is now 1:28 p.m. on the East Coast.
Corey, I think we had it, might have been later last week, that people are divorcing in order to afford Obamacare. It is busting up families. Obamacare is going to increase the divorce rate.
I think it will. Consider quit your job and get welfare, tax incentives, and Obamacare incentives along with tax incentives.
Jim, I just have to ask you a question, though. What do you have against divorce? What business? Do you realize who says marriage is all that great anyway? And who says that marriage does all that much? What's the big deal about people getting divorced? What is your animus against marriage and divorce? What the hell do you care?
Well, I think it's a very important issue when it comes to children involved. Children brought up in a marriage between a husband and wife are definitely, statistically, are shown to be more stable and brought up properly. And just divorce in itself is a deterioration of American societies and morals.
Now, Jim, that's okay in Jacksonville, but you go to Washington or New York and you just became a bigot.
All right,
this
folks.
Has everything.
Wow, Limbaugh really throws the kitchen sink at this. Now, you know that they can't use the talking point anymore about part-time jobs because the latest job surveys, in fact, all the job surveys over the past year have shown that there are no more part-time hiring than normal. And so now they're moving on to divorce, and you'll notice that this ditto head does Rush Limbaugh the favor of saying divorce is horrible when there's kids involved, as opposed to your three divorces, Rush. And of course, Rush Limbaugh is going to say that the people in Washington, they don't think divorce is a problem, and also in Florida, where I am now. The level of desperation now, there is not a single data point or reason why you would divorce because of Obamacare. Now, it's possible, I guess, if you were reliant on your spouse's health care, and that's the only reason why you were staying married, then you had the opportunity to get health care on your own, so you decided to divorce. I would imagine that those are not huge numbers, but in the event, isn't that about freedom? I don't have to worry about that. I get divorced because I'll just pay them to get their own health insurance. Unbelievable how sad this man has become.
How many conservatives do you think at this very moment listening with their wife that they've been trying to find a way to divorce is turning to their wife right now and going, honey, we should just do it for Obama because of Obamacare.
Check the exchanges. See if you're eligible. I mean, assuming you were for some reason not married to me. Unbelievable.
Rush is right. It will lead to the divorce.
Oh, that almost sounded like Ariel Castro for a second. I'm sorry.
Hope Feld, with 203,000 initial guests for November, net additional jobs from Bureau of Labor Statistics, Establishment Survey, and revisions of 8,000 jobs from the prior 2 months. Recovery is well underway. The average hours worked inched up to 34.5 from 34.4 last per week. More workers working longer hours. The U6 unemployment rate, which includes discouraged workers who gave up looking at involuntary part-timers, dropped to 13.2 from a revised October 14%, almost a full percentage point drop. The household survey, where statisticians call up workers and ask them if they were looking for work and whether they are working or whether they have retired or dropped out, showed an increase in the labor force. As people are a little more optimistic in finding work, let's hope we have an even bigger jump in December. Wouldn't that cause the unemployment rate to actually go up as you have more people looking for work? Household survey showed an increase of jobs of almost 800,000. Give us an old-time Obama recovery and let's get 300,000 additional jobs soon. There have been many left in the labor force by retiring early, who have left the labor force by retiring early, like me. But usually, you don't retire before age 40. Wink. Retirees don't come back, so a smaller increase in jobs would do for now. Saddy face. Allow me to just. From Jason Furman, who was not so smart. I could have been. A square. Sam missed the first 10 minutes. Is Cliff related to Danny Schechter, who was on Chris' show last night? I don't think so. Lucky I saw Mandela at New York City 1990 parade. If it's not been said today, when Mandela said, said Amandla, the people responded, Awethu. Power to us. What a life. What a man. Thanks for talking about his militancy as well as his stand for peace and reconciliation. He used all in his arsenal to fight the evil of apartheid, and all who stood, screamed, marched for divestment, or even bought the Steve Van Zandt signal, not going to play Sun City. That is part of solidarity. HGFK, please do a random Rush today. He's going off about how Obama doesn't live up to Mandela's legacy, and it's making my head explode. Militant apathy. Maybe you should get an animated show. I would be a writer for you. Maybe we should start doing animated versions of this.
We need to take full advantage of Michael's talents.
Yes.
That, as we were discussing before the show, without a doubt came from his alone time during homeschooling.
Yes, we were trying to figure out why Michael's so good at impressions, and it's because he was so lonely as a child. that he had to pretend.
I needed to create that Bill Clinton and Nelson Mandela.
That's right.
And others were my teachers.
I've got friends, Mom. Why, just today, Nelson Mandela came by to play with me.
Hi, Michael. This is Bill Clinton. I'll be your principal for this homeschooling journey and your education that lies ahead of you. I could not be more proud.
Al Gore told me to turn off the lights before.
You're a very ecologically conscious young man.
William Buckley was here, and he made me a sandwich.
Oh, my God. I cannot do a William Buckley impression.
It's been too long since you heard him, right, or no?
I mean, he was, I must have heard like a YouTube clip of him or something, but I think he was, wasn't he kind of done by the, like in the 90s or even?
I don't remember what he sounds like. I got to listen to him. Bob Flav, I don't see who's the caboose on the Majority Report website. You should sell it directly instead of having us go to Amazon. I'll buy one for sure. Let's do it. Well, you also get a free one for becoming a member if you want. Go to member benefits. Send us an email, majorityreporters@gmail.com. Red, I remember the dark days of No Sam Cedar Broadcast Podcast app. Thank the Big Daddy, Big Dad, Angry Daddy figure up in the sky that those days are gone. Thank you, Red. Elmech, I love your show. Been a member for about 6 months. Credo's unlimited data plan got me. I pay $185 for an AT&T family plan, but will switch in days. Michael's impressions are epic. Garth, thanks for having Sharpling on. My two heroes, Tom and Sam. My pleasure. Triangle Bill, Sam, I love your film, A Bad Situationist. Brilliant analysis today on the third way stuff and how the true honest populism is a massive threat to corporatists, whether they are Dems or Republicans. You're absolutely correct. In my opinion, the actual populism on the left is much more of a real threat. Populism on the right is just ignorance nonsense. I wonder if Bill O'Reilly, when he traveled extensively around South Africa, looked around and was surprised that no one was throwing fried chicken at each other and shouting, Mother effer, mo sweet tea, ugh.
Do you remember that?
A good...
So O'Reilly went to eat at a famous restaurant.
Oh, yeah,
Harlem.
He went uptown in Harlem.
What's the name of that restaurant?
He was shocked. I can't remember.
It was like
on 116th Street, 115th
Harlem
Street.
Harlem right Institution Restaurant. Right. He's just like, and they weren't saying, hey, MF-er, where's my tea at? Bill O'Reilly thinks that life is like, I watched, you know, Big Mama's House too, and I was shocked
I
that life doesn't
it.
Match that.
Nobody said, shut your mouth. I, in anticipation of going, what's the name of it? It's a woman's name.
Talking about.
I can't remember her name. In preparation, I watched all sorts of blaxploitation movies. I watched Dolomite.
Sylvia's.
I watched Shaft. I was just shocked.
I even watched Blackula, and nothing prepared me for what happened.
F. Sounds like you're caving into the 1%. I don't know what that's in reference to, but of course I've caved. Are you kidding? Oh, you mean the Friday thing? Indeed. Eggnog. Ever thought of marketing the show with a compilation of Michael not speaking into his microphone, interspersed with that microphone story he told last week? You'd be making Limbaugh-level cash.
Well, all I can say to that is fuck you.
Bingo Mosquito, this is Joe down in the Majority Report sales department. We still need phones. when we got the letter, when I got the letters from the patent troll, they wanted to do a video conference call with me, and They actually even wanted me to, like, will you put some technology on your computer to do it? Like, you know, can you please put my PC or whatever the heck it was? I can't remember. And I spent days, like, contemplating, should I do this? Because I had the whole thing planned out. And Nikki was like, don't do this. You screw yourself all the time. What if they come and decide they're going to sue you? You're done. And I was like, yeah, but this could be so fun. And my whole plan was to sit there and have them on video screen and record the conversation, obviously, of course, and have them say things like, what is your revenue? And I would say, well, hold on. Let me call. Let me get the CEO here for you. And I would grab the clip-on tie and be like, hello, I'm the CEO. What is the question? How much revenue? Well, let me get accounting. And then I would, accounting, get up here. And then
and Sam would reappear.
Put on like an accounting cap. Yes, boss, what can I do for you? What is our numbers for November? Well, sir, let me check. Let me get with our comptroller. And
just comptroller? Look at the, amazing.
The look on the people's face that I was imagining as I'm doing this, like, stupid sketch. And my father was like, you know, they're going to, if they depose you for a lawsuit, they're going to compare what you said in this interview with what you're saying in the deposition. And I'm like, but I'm a satirist, and if I'm dressing up in costume as I do this, I think it's going to be clear to a judge that I was just playing a character. Like, we have $1 million here. Hold on. Let me check. Yes. Please bring up all the cash.
Open the vaults, please.
Open the vaults, please. Hold on. Let me see. Let me punch in the code to the vault. And Nikki was like, please don't do this. Because if they sue you, because if they had... I don't have Adam Carolla's cash reserves. Had they sued me, it would have been, that's the show, folks. Bye.
See, in some ways, the funniest part of the story is that your wife being like, honey, could you please not risk bankruptcy for a 15-minute prank over Skype? That would be great.
But this would be so funny. And I was just like, can you imagine the look on the face of like these attorneys? Just like, what's going on here? What is he doing? Because I imagine like these guys just thought that like we had this huge operation, and I don't know. It would have been
truth
funny.
Be told. I mean, it could have gone viral.
Yeah, it would have been viral.
Yeah, I mean, people would have done it. It would have gotten some traction.
I mean, and somebody said to me, like, how many hits do you think this could get? And I was like, this could get like 100,000 hits on YouTube. And they're like, well, and that would be great. It would be so funny.
We talk about stuff like this in the office without the, you know, off air all the time. I'm convinced that if someone gave Sam some sort of deal, we would have the most successful TV show of all time.
What kind of
like a sitcom of some sort where you're just randomly doing stuff like connecting the ideas that you've had in this office. I think it would be hilarious.
Ideas are a dime a dozen, my man.
But you pull through in the office with them.
We'll see. Shanksteel, friggin' awesome hilarity. Thanks, guys. Check out the Christmas candle. Sammy Kammer, Michael's Mandela was hilarious. Sort of just sort of almost obscene to like, right? Hey, your Mandela was hilarious today. Carl Sagan.
Obviously not how it was meant.
This morning I heard...
Sam, I hope you will work with me to fight for the preservation of the pharmaceutical company's proper dividends for their shareholders, which is threatened by the cheap importation of drugs from outside of U.S. borders. Nothing is a greater threat to freedom.
The donut hole must be maintained.
Why not the cost of living adjustment on Social Security? Age expect life expectancy has gone up significantly.
This morning I heard Ari Reibenhoff interview the writer for the Third Way op-ed. He criticized expanding Social Security as a losing electoral strategy. It said other budget issues are a bigger priority, as if seniors can have retirement security or medical care, but not both. The idea that expanding Social Security is a political loser is, I'm
like
shocked.
Saying that losing like your virginity in high school or college is unpopular. I mean, I know that's it's crass.
I would go even further. I would say that's like, if you offer, I mean, I don't even know like what that would be like saying, if you offer people Social Security, that would be bad. I don't think there is anything more popular in terms of a political policy in this country than Social Security. Laws against, I was going to say laws against shooting people, but I mean, like, stand your ground. Anti-stealing laws maybe have more popularity. I have no idea. He said at the beginning of the conversation, we've gotten all the tax revenue that we're going to be able to squeeze out of people. And then at the end of the conversation, he said, third way supports raising taxes on rich people. Well, isn't lifting the cap raising tax on rich people? Third way, don't even take him that seriously. It's not that they want to hold every position at once. They have an agenda. They are just lying. This conversation is inevitably leading to the delegitimization of the 401k plan. I think with what's happening, retirees here in Detroit, that this is going to become a very heated disagreement indeed. C. McDonald, today in Canada is the day of remembrance for 14 female engineering students murdered at École Polytechnique in Montreal in 1989. Smith & Wesson shares are up 56% from the 52-week low they hit just days after the Newtown shooting. Cabela's shares have gained more than 60%. Ruger stock is up 82%. Ammunition makers Olin and Alliant Technosystems have popped this year as well. Yeah. Sam, when you get a moment to look at the latest Ted Rall cartoon to counter the racist allegations, Ted has replaced Obama with a yellow smiley head. What world do we now live in? Everyone on the loyal side of Obama jumped on Rawl, including Joy Reid at MSNBC. That's sad. But none of them had the insight into look at Rawl's past work to see he drew presidents with the same features. If you can't draw a president as goofy, the hope and change train is derailed completely, in my opinion. Your thoughts? I saw his cartoon. I just don't think that he is his drawing is racist. I don't. I don't.
You're looking at me. I didn't even see the cartoon.
I'm just looking in a...
Oh, okay.
No, I don't. I mean, I didn't follow what happened on Daily Kos, but it's... You know, I don't think he was drawing him as racist. I mean, in a racist manner. I don't think Ted Rawls... has any history that would indicate that he's racist. I think that there are people out there who can see no fault in President Obama. And they conflate issues. I have said this many times before that intent and context is the determinant factor in my mind and in issues of this. I think that in certain instances, if you know you're going to do something that's offensive and you think your intent may be misconstrued, then you have to be willing to accept criticism. I don't think, and those charges, I don't even think that what Rawl was doing reaches that level. I mean, I know, you know, on this program, even when I was on radio, I used the word nigger. I used the word kike. I've used other words that I know people find offensive. I don't do it to get a rise out of people. I do it to explicate things. And I think that intent and context is important. I just don't even think that Ted Rall, what he was drawing, had risen to even that that level. I just don't. I mean,
when you use those words, you're quoting other people.
I'm quoting other people, or I mean, I'm you know, when I think in the context on radio, I use those words. When George Allen was using Makaka to explain to people what the equivalent was for a guy who grew up knowing what that word meant. If someone who had not been raised by someone and had not been exposed to the use of that word macaca as being the functional equivalent of the N-word for people of Southeast Asian descent, had said macaca, it would not mean the same thing. It wouldn't, because they wouldn't know what the implications of that word were. If someone uses an anti-Semitic trope that they're not aware is an anti-Semitic trope, you know, I mean, I've had people who, in the course of conversations with me over my lifetime, have said, like, man, I went to go buy something at this open air market and I Jewed the guy down. And the use of that word, you know, Jewed down, is obviously anti-Semitic. Well, they didn't even realize that that was offensive. And upon hearing that explanation, going forward, it has a different meaning for them.
Did they say, hey, buddy, don't Jew me out of my terminology?
I mean, I'll tell you, I remember being 9 or 10 years old on some camp field trip. And I think we were going hiking or something. Some kids had taken like the ski lift to go up there. It was like some hill in Worcester or something.
Oh, that's called the Jew route.
The Jew route. And the counselor asked me, where did those other kids go? And I go, they acted like pussies and they went up on the chairlift. And he looked at me and he goes, what did you just say? And I said, they acted like pussies. They went up on the, he goes, it's wussy. And I go, wussy? No, it's pussy. And he slapped me across the face.
Whoa.
This guy had a problem aside from this. But I was like, I had no idea. I had never heard the word wussy in my life. I had no idea that there were any, that pussy was anything other than a wimp. I had no idea. Now, if you can manage to get through your life without, being aware of the context or something, then that makes a difference. And I think in Ted Rall's eyes, he's just drawing like he always draws. He's just drawing like he draws other figures. Caricatures, of other presidents and whatnot. And
but obviously, I'm not saying one way or another, but I just, maybe this is where I have a different perspective from you, because it's like, if you draw Bush to look like a chimp and you make those jokes about him that he has kind of simian features or whatever, and by definition, if you draw, and I didn't even see these, so I really don't want to comment on them,
right?
Because I don't like that. But if you draw Obama looking like a chimp and you draw Bush looking like a chimp, that obviously intrinsically means something different.
Yeah.
It has different connotations.
Right, yes.
I mean, that's just reality.
I agree. I don't think he's drawn to look like a chimp in this. I don't see it.
Well, again, I'm definitely not commenting on that. But I'm just saying, because I haven't seen it, but I'm just saying it would be disingenuous to say, oh, I'm just using the same tropes with Obama as I have for other presidents, because obviously there's something different about Obama's president.
Right. And there's obviously more sensitivities there. And I think it's certainly possible for him to have drawn the president in a way that's offensive. I mean, you know, it's just weird that it's coming this late. He's been drawing this guy for a long time like this. And I don't know. I mean, you know, look, if you, the equivalent would be like there were some classic sort of like anti-Semitic drawings of Jews back in the day, right? The big hook nose, the big jowls, sort of like the hunchback. If you go and draw Paul Newman that way, I'm doing a caricature of Paul Newman. And he looks like Shylock. Then, yes, there's an argument. If you draw a guy like, I don't know, I mean, there are actors who look like that. You know, I don't know. That's, then I don't think it's, but I don't know. I don't see it in the
Real
world.
Quick, did the counselor get fired after smacking you, or did you let anybody know?
He had this thing like you would, maybe it wasn't the face, he would like just like punch you in the arm, smarten up. That was, in the side of the head. That was his whole big thing. And then he also had this thing where he would make you, if you got punished, he would make you stand outside in your underwear at night outside the bunk, hold your hands up to get bit by mosquitoes. Yeah, that was his last year there. Yeah. Back in the day, that's the way it would go. How to accept bitcoins on your blog with no code.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. Bitcoin, you mean?
Yeah. Jay Tingle, mad props for Sun City, in which frequent Reagan critic Joey Ramone refers to constructive engagement as a joke. Cyberstrike, damn, the impressions were fantastic. Totally not getting any work done right now. My sides hurt. Victor Rocco, is Michael friends with Yoda? He wants to hear you do a Yoda impression.
Oh, a Yoda impression. I.
Young Michael!
Yeah, oh.
Impressions I will do.
Whoa. I can't do Yoda. I just don't remember what it sounds like. I haven't
friends
seen that movie.
You have, Michael. It's not quite there. I got to listen more to do that.
That's a hard impression.
Yeah. Wowzers, this fun half is getting out of control today. You guys probably should have an intricate conversation about derivatives to bring it down a notch, just so the freebie listeners feel at home. Be seen from Media Matters feed. Limbaugh uses Mandela's death to lecture American civil rights leaders about forgiveness. Oh, my God.
Heed the words of my friends at Fox News and other important outlets.
Clower, you
Oprah
guys...
and Barack Obama have threatened the white race, and this is unacceptable.
Clower, you guys are hitting on all cylinders today. Chimp Evil, great Mandela, Michael. I never realized before then now that he was a Jewish man. Explains his resolve. Spay F, yesterday I was referring to the municipal workers in Detroit. I keep hearing that they do not get Social Security. In Oregon, we get both the pension and Social Security. I was wondering who was responsible for negotiating such a risky, not downright deal for those workers. I am not sure, but I think you get actual extra benefits on non-Social Security in those pensions. But yes, it is risky. Bingo Mosquito, Bill O'Reilly watched That's My Mama episodes. Left Coast Marcus, you referred to longtime supporter as she. Did George Soros get a sex change? No.
Wait, can I ask, does he mean That's My Mama is a joke from Coming to America? Is that what he's referring
that's
to?
That's My Mama was a TV show, I think, or something like that.
I think it was a joke about a bad TV show in Coming
I
to
think
America.
So, yeah. Madam Merfucker will do it live. Scott Ricketts, Sam, you should have done like a Crash Craddock deal with a picture of Scrooge McDuck as the CEO with big piles of gold behind you. Radonna, I have been a little emotional about Mandela's death. Did not expect to be choking with laughter to hear him promoting the private healthcare industry. Hal Rager, the voices, I laugh, I cry from laughing, fall down, laugh. I love you guys. Nelly Girl. Michael's Mandela was the best bit ever. Thank goodness I was not drinking my tea when he did it. Love the show as always. Little Gray. Ted Rawl is no racist. He doesn't care about Obama's race. He cares that he's a warmonger, that he needs to tend to draw all warmongers in a simian-like manner. Strangely, though, Rahl attacked Nelson Mandela in a post essentially for giving up militarism as a tactic. Strange guy, that Rahl. Yeah, I'm not saying that I agree with all of Rahl's politics. And, you know, I think that there is something to be said that he should have more consciousness of, if he's consciously drawing him like a simian, then I think it's, you know, somewhat of a problem. I mean, I haven't read anything he said, but, again, I don't think that Ted Rahl's issues with Obama are racist. I just don't. Monorail. My problem with the Ted Rahl cartoon would be that Obama isn't recognizable as Obama. Not that it's very apish. But I think he does that with all his things, doesn't he? All right, folks. We got to go. See you Monday.
It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want. But I know somehow I'm gonna get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the light bulb. But finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in. And my pilot light shining bright. I get somewhere the choice is made, for the option where you don't get paid, for the road that bends before it finally breaks you. I get somehow I lost my drive, between the 101 and the 5. Do you know takes you? Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in, and my pilot light shining shifted in and out of key, waiting for my moment to happen. I don't know how much longer I can stay in, or how much more I got to pay.